Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Today's guest is the medical director for the Northwell Health House Calls Program, as well as Northwell Health's Clinical Call Center. Northwell's House Calls Program provides both primary care services and urgent care in the home, serving nearly 2,000 homebound individuals annually. Before joining Northwell Health, today's guest worked as a hospitalist at the Mount Sinai Medical Center, and she earned her medical degree from the Pennsylvania State University College of Medicine. She holds bachelor's degrees in both biochemistry and violin performance. Welcome, Dr. Karen Abrashkin.
Thank you so much.
So to begin with, tell our listeners a little something about your background. How did you decide to pursue a medical career, and how did you get into the role you're in now?
Well, thank you very much. So I took a somewhat unusual road in terms of getting into medicine. I started off as a violinist, and during my undergraduate time got involved in some research opportunities, which eventually led me to become interested in sciences and in medicine. And I always had a feeling of wanting to do something meaningful and really wanting to help people. And that took me down the road of medical school at Penn State. And eventually, I did my residency at Mount Sinai, and I stayed on as a hospitalist there for a couple of years. And then I was presented with the opportunity to join the House Calls program. And it seemed like just that opportunity I was looking for in terms of doing something really meaningful and making a difference in people's lives. And so I joined about 6.5 years ago and haven't looked back ever since.
And that House Calls program you're talking about, it's considered a model for innovation in providing emergent and urgent care in the home, something that's very exciting to us because we're trying to make a lot of efforts to make the communication center more of a hub for or access to broader kinds of care rather than just calling and getting an ambulance. So tell us a little bit about that House Calls program. How did it get started and what kinds of services do you provide?
Our House Calls program has been around for about 7 years now in its current form. We provide primary care services within the patient's home, and we're really looking for the most frail, medically complex individuals who can't get out of the home to seek regular medical care. So we provide a multidisciplinary care team. We have physicians, nurse practitioners, nurses, social workers, medical coordinators. We all work together in this team-based approach to provide both ongoing primary care as well as urgent and emergent care in the home. And generally, our patients are older. Our average age is about 86, and our patients want to stay home. They will go to the hospital if needed, but they're at that age, they're really focused on, many people are focused on their quality of life, staying home, being with their family. And so we're able to go in and provide this primary care as well as the urgent and emergent care. And that's really where our dispatchers and our community paramedics as well as our nurse call center come in terms of keeping patients home where they prefer to be. We have our 24/7 nurse call center that we work closely with. They are available to triage patients, and we use them as the primary triage. We have a one-call-does-it-all type number here. We have one main number. And depending on the phone tree prompt that the patient picks, the call will go either to somebody in our office during business hours, or it will go to our dispatcher or to our clinical call center. So if a patient is having an emergent condition, they will press option one for an emergency, still coming through our same main number, so they still are calling the House Calls program, and the call will be routed to our nursing call center, where we have an ECNS call center. If the nurse doesn't answer within 30 seconds as a safety net, our calls are routed to the EMDs, who then will pick up the call and will be the patient's first point of contact in terms of that emergency. We have two different phone trees, of course, during hours and after hours, but our press one is always for emergency, no matter what time it is, and so our dispatchers are involved in our patient's care around the clock, depending on what the situation is.
And those dispatchers, let's say that they get one of these calls because someone in the nurse center isn't available to pick up. Can they actually send out or notify resources from your program rather than sending an ambulance?
Yes. If the caller is calling specifically for an ambulance, the dispatcher will, by regular protocol, send out an ambulance. But if the call that's coming into the dispatcher is for anything else besides just calling for an ambulance right at that moment, the dispatcher will actually act as the conduit between the caller and one of our providers here in the house calls program, and will be able to warm transfer the call to us after speaking with the patient and finding out what the nature of the call is.
And how do they know whether this is someone who's in one of your house call programs?
Because everything is coming through the kind of one call does it all number, and we have the Avaya phone system, both in our call center and in our CEMS center, our Center for Emergency Medical Services, they will see on the wall board that the call is coming from a house calls patient.
That's interesting. One of the things you and I discussed was the importance of having this holistic team all working together. And that's kind of what you're talking about, where you have a one call does it all. You have this safety net system. And you mentioned one of the things that's very important is to integrate all those providers together to really provide, to really create a culture that rewards that holistic care and where everybody works together. So how did you go about that? How do you build a culture like that where everyone from the dispatchers to the emergency physicians to the nurses are all on the same page?
I think in terms of our house calls program, the people you have working in the program are really the core of the culture of the program. Finding the right individuals who want to deliver care in this way is extremely important. And I think it does trickle down in terms of how our providers, our physicians and our nurse practitioners, treat everybody on the team. Do they have the mindset of everybody being important, everyone being somebody who's providing care to the patient? So we specifically look for people for our program who want to participate in this type of care model. On the dispatcher side, the dispatchers do receive extra kind of training and understanding about house calls and about how the program works, and do receive instruction also in terms of the fact that they're part of the team. I always tell our providers here, we can't control who the patient talks to on the team. And actually, it's really not as important as, you know, it doesn't matter if they talk to a dispatcher, if they talk to the call center, if they talk to one of our medical coordinators, if they talk to our physician. Whatever point of contact, we have to give the patient the reassurance that they've called the right place, that we are here to help, and our dispatchers are so good about doing that. I think even more so than other folks who are not used to dealing with continuous emergencies, the dispatchers are always cool, calm, and collected when they're interacting with our patients. It's so important how the patient feels when they speak with the dispatcher, because if they have a bad experience, if that's their first call to our program, their first call really could be, their first interaction could be with a dispatcher. And if they're turned off by a lack of caring or a perceived lack of caring, how they're treated, that reflects directly on the house calls program and impacts our ability to build trust with that patient and family. And so the dispatchers really are a very, very important part of our program, and an important part of the care team. That's how we speak about it in the house calls program to our providers, and I hope that that's how the message is kind of transmitted to other people on the care team, that everyone is very important, and all of their contacts very much matter in terms of building that relationship of trust with the patient and family.
One of the things that's interesting about that for me, and I think for dispatchers, is they become involved in much longer-term health care relationships. So a 911 dispatcher, for example, may take a number of calls back-to-back, but they're all from different people, and most people call 911 one time in their lives. And so emergency dispatchers deal with a new person every time they pick up the call, whereas you're talking about a really long-term health relationship with somebody. So how are you integrating the emergency or urgent nature of some of these incidents, or maybe the one-time interaction that an individual at the call center has with this person, with your longer-term relationship with that patient?
That's an interesting question. I think it's a little bit different for the dispatchers and for the call center and then for our house calls team. For the call center, they are documenting in the record. They're using ECNS. They are having these extensive conversations. They're getting to know patients, our frequent callers. For the dispatchers, I'm always impressed in terms of the caring and concern that they are showing each of the callers because they may have never spoken to that person before. But I do have a feeling also that with our frequent callers, we do have individuals who are getting more frequent community paramedic responses, more frequent calls, that the dispatchers do get to know them as well. And there are, people, all of the patients on our house calls program have advanced illness and are at very high risk of having a change in condition. And so I'm sure that we're physically separated from our dispatchers. We're about 20 minutes away. And so they're disconnected not only from seeing the patients physically, from other aspects of the care, but they're also disconnected from our program. But somehow they seem very integrated whenever our patients call. And I can only imagine that they get to know the people's names as they call frequently. Because on the house calls program, we're taking patients generally in the last 24 months to 36 months of life. People have a lot of medical needs around that time. And so we do get very frequent calls.
Huh. I mean, to me, one of the things that really stands out about that is I think a lot of emergency call centers, the term frequent caller isn't a term for someone that they have a long-term relationship with, but more someone who might be a problem. So it's very interesting to flip that around and say, actually, frequent callers are people that you have the opportunity to really form a relationship with over time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a difference. So you can view things in different ways. So for us, when our patients start to call very frequently, we know something is going on. We know that that's a sign that there's some kind of change in condition that's going on, that the patient is having a deterioration of their medical problems. We do also have people who call frequently because they live alone, because they don't have somebody with whom they can talk to. At the same time, it's very nice that our own dispatchers, our own nurses, can be the ones taking those calls, because we also find out about every one of those calls. So we know if there's something that's going on, why all of a sudden is this person calling in the middle of the night and, speaking with the dispatcher and we're getting our alerts that they've called. Has something changed? Are they becoming depressed? Has their spouse died and now they're alone? Are they having some type of change in terms of their mental health conditions? All of these types of things, I think it's a mistake to look at somebody who calls frequently in a program like ours as kind of as a problem. This is a sign that something is changing and that they need some sort of intervention. And that's how we try to look at it here.
I actually think that could be a workable or an important model for all 911 centers in the sense that frequent callers can maybe people who are kind of making a sign that they need some other kind of help. And in fact, there have been a couple of other programs in other places where they actually use frequent caller information to go out and find those people and figure out what other kinds of services do they need. And so you're kind of doing it preemptively or before the fact, finding people who have a need for service and providing that to them and integrating the 911 center into that instead of waiting for someone to call and then figuring out, oh, this person has some other need.
Yeah, and every time that our patients speak with one of our dispatchers, we receive a first watch alert to notify us of the call, whether that's that they spoke with the dispatcher and then the call was transferred, they spoke with the dispatcher and they got a CP response, a community paramedic response, an ambulance was dispatched, so we know about all the interactions that they're having with our dispatchers. And so it's not infrequent that on a Monday, when we're hearing about everything that happened over the weekend from our on-call provider, there's comments in the room of, oh, geez, that person seems to be calling more frequently. Mm-hmm. Oh, I saw some first watch alerts from when that person called and spoke with the dispatcher. And so we all really work together as a team within the program using all of the data that comes from our dispatchers as well to figure out what the patient needs at that time.
That points to sort of a larger systemic question. And, this is not a program that operates for free, obviously. You know, this is an investment for your organization, for your health system. What was it that triggered this program? Why did they seek out this particular population? Why did they set up this program? What would lead a health system to make this sort of investment?
We are very lucky at Northwell to have forward-thinking leadership and to make the investment now in building this kind of program when, at this point, the revenue streams don't exist really to cover the cost of our care. The leadership of our health system made the investment in this program, though, because in the future, new payment models are going to be opening through CMS. I mean, there's so many individuals who want to age in place who just can't do it. I mean, and they're going into nursing homes, which is extremely costly and has unintended consequences. They're going into the hospital more frequently because they don't have support at home, which is then, again, costly. And then they go into maybe some kind of subacute rehab, which is costly, when treating them in the home would have saved a lot of expense down the road. And so new models of payment are going to be rolling out. Exactly when that's going to happen, I don't know, but many things are on the table from CMS. We also are entering into a number of managed care arrangements. Based on our results with the Medicare demonstration that we participate in now, which is called Independence at Home, this is basically a Medicare demonstration across the entire country. About 14 programs are enrolled currently, and they're looking at whether home-based medical care can provide higher quality care at a lower cost. So there's many quality benchmarks that have to be met, and then the total cost of care is also evaluated. And what our program has shown is that we have been able to provide really high quality care at a lower cost than what would otherwise be expected. And so as Medicare sees these demonstrations, new payment models will be emerging. And then we've also used those results to look at managed care arrangements. So arrangements with specific insurance payers to take care of their highest risk, highest need patients in a home-based medical care model. And so that's one of the other steps towards sustainability when you're looking at the managed care patients.
And if I remember correctly, CMS, which is Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, one of the things they're actually doing is including patient evaluation or patient satisfaction with their care as one of the outcomes. So it used to be that really cost for care or payment was the primary or only measure. But like you're saying, patient satisfaction and the quality of care are now, if not equal, at least very important goals and metrics that have to be met. So you get to look at the outcomes in terms of cost savings, but also in terms of patient satisfaction.
That's correct. And we find that the patient satisfaction piece is so important that even before it was required in any way, we've been sending out a survey for the last 6-7 years to gauge our patients' satisfaction with the program, with specific aspects of the program, to make sure that as we've expanded and grown the program, that we're maintaining the same very high quality. So we even before we had a more official type of survey, we were even sending out our internally created survey and aggregating all of our data to make sure that we're really performing in what we refer to as patient-specific outcomes or patient-important outcomes. So things like quality of life, being better able to manage your illnesses, overall satisfaction with the program are really important, and that's what we're here for. That's what we strive for. We're not going to cure all of our patients. Our patients are 86. As I said, they're in kind of the final phase of their life. And so giving them the tools to manage their health conditions, to have a good quality of life in that final phase is what we're aiming to do, and also to respect their goals of care. So if somebody wants to go back to the hospital, by all means they can, and we coordinate very closely with the inpatient team in terms of what's going on, but most of our patients don't want to. And so we have to make sure that we are really honoring our patients' goals of care in terms of their satisfaction and all the different components of the program.
And I know you just talked about a survey. I know you've been collecting other data about the program and how it's going. What would you say are the one or two most interesting or important outcomes that you've found from the analysis that you've done on the program?
I think the takeaway for house calls is that sometimes going back to really the essence of medical care gives you the best outcomes. So going to the patient's home, building a trusting relationship, spending the time, even if the outcome isn't going to be cure or isn't going to be more quantity of life, that is what people want, and that's what patients are asking for. There's also, you know, we've collected a lot of data on our community paramedicine program, and we've found that when paramedics go out to our patients' homes, our patients absolutely love the program. It's because it allows them to stay home. You know, the term aging in place is something that's a more common term now. People want to age in place. And so even though in the medical community you tend to think of cure, get better, that's the goal, one of the takeaways from a program like this is that that's not always possible, but you can still have a really huge impact.
Yeah. One of the things that we talk about is you can't save everyone, but you can help everyone, or you can provide service to everyone. And it's an interesting and important question because, you know, you've worked in palliative and end-of-life care, and it's a very different approach from what's been traditional in healthcare, and especially in emergency services, where the focus is very heavily on the save, on survival as the only meaningful outcome. So do you have any advice for emergency services or communication centers to better serve people for whom survival is not the only or even maybe the desired outcome?
I think it is a mindset change, as you've said. If the mindset is not, in this population, the mindset is not necessarily the percentage of patients who achieve spontaneous circulation, in whom CPR is successful. But we've had many situations in which paramedics have gone out to a patient's home, and it's clear that the patient's in the dying process, and the paramedic has sat at the home with the physician on the phone providing all of the oversight and guidance, but the paramedic has been the one who sat at the home providing comfort-oriented treatments in the patient's final minutes of life. And that's a very different role for kind of a paramedic and emergency medical services individual to provide, and it is so meaningful for our patients. The letters that we get, the gratitude that patients, you know, even in that time after somebody passes, it is so meaningful to them that they write a letter about how much these specific emergency medical personnel meant in their loved one's final minutes or hours of life. It really speaks to the impact that emergency medical services can have in this kind of different care model.
Yeah, in a related sense, too, I think a lot of emergency medical services, a lot of 911 centers are seeing an increase in the calls that they're receiving or the patients that they see who are not necessarily having a traditional emergency. So they didn't fall off of something or they're not having a heart attack. We're seeing a lot more access to emergency services for, like you're saying, older patients, people with multiple diseases, people who have maybe lower acuity conditions but are very complex medically in terms of having a lot of comorbidities. So how do you see the emergency field changing to become more responsive to these kinds of events?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think as the U.S. population is aging, the demand for these services is just going to grow tremendously. To think of, you know, our patients experience both exacerbations of their chronic illnesses as well as things that are not related to their chronic illnesses. And that's just going to become the norm. People are going to be more complicated. There's always going to be the traditional emergency services, of course, for people who are younger, who are less medically frail. But I think the demand for these services is just going to increase. That's very much my hope, because I think this is a model of care that's very meaningful to patients and can honor their wishes, help them make the most out of whatever time they have, and also understand what to them means the most. Is the most going back to the hospital over and over? If it is, that's fine. Is the most staying home and trying interventions at home? But I think the emergency field, I'm hoping, will be changing as our population changes, as our population ages and becomes more chronically ill, to respond to what patients want and what families want in terms of goals of care, location of services. And the only way that that's going to happen is, number one, with patient and family demand and pressure, but also to have reimbursement mechanisms that allow for that type of care in some somewhat sustainable manner. So hopefully all of these things are going to come together, the aging of our population, the voice of the patient and the family, and then also adequate reimbursement to cover these types of services that patients and families want.
One of the things you mentioned when we talked earlier that I thought was interesting and that I think can come up for emergency dispatchers, whether they're working in a program like yours or just in a center handling 911 calls, is the issue of the DNR, the Do Not Resuscitate order, and I think more generally the issue of what you're talking about, which is the patient's wishes for care, their desires as far as what measures they want to have taken. I know a lot of times when emergency dispatchers get a call and then a person has a DNR in place or has certain wishes in place, there can be sort of a tension between that wish on the patient's or family's part and the dispatcher's desire, appropriate desire, to provide all the help that they can in the moment, all the resuscitative care and so on. Where do you see training or support for emergency dispatchers to help them negotiate those kinds of complex situations?
Yeah, I think some of it is going to come from emergency services in terms of negotiating the situation, but a lot of the onus is really on us as primary care providers to prepare the patient for that moment, especially when you're talking about somebody who has multiple chronic illnesses. You always hope for the best, but plan for the worst. And so what we do before any kind of emergency comes up is that we're very comprehensive in terms of our advanced care planning. So we explain to all of our patients the importance of filling out your goals. In New York State, we use a form called the MULST, the Medical Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. About 90% of our patients have a completed MULST form. And anybody who doesn't have a form, it's because they have elected not to fill it out. No matter what a patient's condition is, we will speak with the patient or the family about the importance of just making the wishes known, because you can't make that decision at the time of the emergency. And so as primary care providers in society, have to start having those types of conversations earlier so that when an emergency comes up, we're prepared for what somebody wants. We also have our patients actually put their advance directives on their refrigerator, and we explain to them that if any paramedic comes, you need to have access to this form so that they can honor your wishes and do what you want. We also try to change the language around advanced care planning in terms of, this isn't, sometimes in the medical field you hear people trying to push for a DNR or push for a do not resuscitate order in some way, which really is not in the spirit of advanced care planning. So we talk about it more as a gift. You're giving your family a gift that if you can't make your own decisions, they know what you would want. And so we try to change how we're talking about advanced care planning. But I think that understanding where the records are, what types of records in your location can exist, is extremely important in the emergency medical field. But if the conversations don't happen before the emergency, it's very hard. You just can't have that conversation at the time of a crisis.
I love that you put it that way about giving a gift to the family, because one of the things that we hear on calls is the dispatcher talking to a family member and the family member saying something like, I think they have a DNR, or I think we talked about this, or I'm not sure what they would want. And then the dispatcher is left trying to negotiate with this family member what the wishes might be, or whether care should be provided, or what have you. And neither of them is getting really what they need out of that interaction, because nobody knows exactly what the patient would have wanted. So I really like that idea of saying, okay, this is a gift to somebody who may have to make a very difficult decision.
Yes, and we see a lot of confusion in terms of a living will versus a healthcare proxy versus a DNR, and kind of what different things mean kind of in a legal sense when an emergency happens. So we do spend a lot of time with our patients and families explaining that, and that's extremely important. And then also just reminding the family. I mean, a lot of our patients don't necessarily use smartphones, but we encourage the patient's family members either to make photocopies, to keep the copies somewhere, to give it to other family members, to leave the original with the patient. Some of our family members take pictures on their smartphones so that they have it in case somebody goes into the hospital. And we just really try to emphasize the importance of the document and how that's the only way that somebody's wishes are going to be respected.
Before we go, I would actually like to ask you one more question sort of on a bigger systematic scale, which is you were talking about there are going to be more avenues for reimbursement for these kinds of care. There are certainly more evaluations or more metrics around aging in place, patient satisfaction, quality of care. Where do you see these kinds of programs like the one that you're working on being integrated into the larger healthcare model? What's the future for this kind of mobile care and care in place?
My hope and my goal would be that in the future, this model of care would be available across the country to anybody who needs it. I'm hoping that in the future there'll be a much more fluid type of care model where there's just more collaboration amongst physician groups, amongst emergency medicine providers, even local community-based organizations who are seeing patients or individuals who have difficulties getting out of the home. And if the payment would support this model of care, which is much more expensive than traditional care upfront, but very much delivers much higher quality and saves money in the long run for people who really need it. But if the reimbursement existed so that people could get this type of care more easily, more programs will open, more programs will be able to expand, and I would hope that it would be much more fluid, as I said, just in terms of maybe you only need home-based primary care for a certain amount of time, like after you've had a hospitalization, and then you're going to go back to your primary care doctor, and everybody's really working in concert for the benefit of the patient. At this point, we try to work very much as an integrated care model, but things are more segregated. You're on the house calls program. You're not necessarily going to be going back to your PCP occasionally. And once you're on our program generally, then you're going to be discharged if for some reason you don't become homebound. And really, a lot of things have to do, everybody wants to do the right thing, but we're just not always able to because of just the real limitations in the real world of providing health care and having to do it in a financially sustainable way. So I think in the future, as reimbursement shifts, as the population ages, as there's more demand for this service, and the word kind of gets out and spreads about the benefits of having this type of service, hopefully programs like ours will really spread across the country. You know, I think there's one other piece that will come into play as the next generation of folks starts to age. There'll be a whole other technology component layered in. Will technology allow us to see more patients, to provide care at home in a different way for aging individuals, to do it at a lower price point? That's certainly possible. We're actually engaged in a pilot here regarding telehealth and how that may help expand our program. But I think it's probably no surprise that it is quite difficult to run a telehealth program with individuals in their 90s who are not accustomed to that technology. But as the next generation of folks ages and develops more health problems, will we have other avenues for delivering care in a less costly way, in a more sustainable way, to grow programs across the country? I think that part remains to be seen, but I'm hopeful that there'll be a real role for technology in expanding services as time goes on.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us. It's a great program that you guys are working on, and also congratulations on being the second ECNS ACE ever.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us, and good luck with your program.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardette. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.